Hello, I'm Josh.
And I'm Christy, and you're listening to the Dr. Josh and Christy podcast,
where we help you become a family who lives, loves, and leads well.
Today's podcast is brought to you by 22-6 Parenting, an online community designed to help you disciple your kids to live, love, and lead well. Check it out at 226parenting.com.
Welcome back to the Dr. Josh and Christy podcast. We are so excited today to have a very dear friend with us, Dr. Meg Meeker. Welcome, Dr. Meeker.
Thanks for having me, Josh and Christy. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yes, we are super excited. There's so much we could talk about today on this episode. We're going to talk about specifically, we're going to kind of gear this conversation towards Dr. Meeker's work and what Meg is doing, especially as it relates to fathers, because it's a topic we haven't focused on too much on our podcast yet. And but first of all, I want to, because I, first of all, I just want to thank you, Meg, because Meg has championed Safe House and wrote the foreword to the book Safe House and has championed us in a really cool way. And there are people out there who come alongside you, support you in whatever work you do. And I just want to make sure that as we even begin this, Meg isn't just an interviewee today. She is a dear champion, friend, mentor, and someone we really look up to. And so I just want to publicly say thank you, Meg, for everything that you've done for us.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, I believe that when you come across friends who are doing great work and who are really going somewhere, you can see God is sort of saying, okay, I want to bring you from point A to B to C to D, that it really is important for others around you to kind of link arms and help you get there. It's people did it for me, and I was so grateful, and I think you give it back, and you give it back. And I mean, it's just a very important thing to do. And rather than sort of living in a spirit of competition, which we should never be, I mean, I think if we're both going in the same direction, our job as friends is to really boost each other up. And I believe on that interdependency rather than the individualism. So I'm thrilled to encourage you guys because I just love what you do and I love to follow your work and I believe so much in your work.
Well, thank you
That's
so much.
That's why we love you so much.
And if you're, and if you're listening to our podcast and you're a fan of our podcast and you're a listener, you have to also be listening to Dr. Meeker's podcast as well, Parenting Great Kids. It goes hand in hand with what we do, and you will deeply benefit from it. So please, if you are a regular listener with us, make sure that you check out hers as well. And there's a good chance you already are listening to her. But
I started listening, Meg, probably like episode 2 or something, and I would listen while I would go on walks late at night, and it was so it was like, you know, you just need space, like you just need headspace.
And I think you need headspace. And the what I try to accomplish in my podcast is that when parents are listening or they walk away, they take a big, deep breath and go, okay, I can do that.
Yes.
You know, I can do that.
That is exactly how you feel. You are, because Meg is a pediatrician, so just a little bit of her background. So she is a pediatrician for how many years, Meg?
Well, over 30 years now, since 84, really. So 33, yeah.
So she has taken all that experience, plus being a mom herself. Her husband is also a pediatrician, so they know what they're talking about. And I feel like you just distill it down for us average parents in a way that it's saying you've got this and it's really not that bad. Even though it feels those light and momentary troubles, right? Like it talks about in the Bible, when they never feel light and momentary. But I feel like you kind of hold the hand and say, you've got it.
You've got it. You know, I remember, and I will tell you quite honestly, I've done a lot of work in my life. You know, my husband and I raised 4 kids. We now have a few grandkids. I've done pediatric residency. I've taught medical school and all this different kind of stuff. The hardest time in my entire life where I thought I couldn't make it was when I had small children at home, because I was physically exhausted because you don't sleep real well. I was mentally exhausted because I was constantly saying no or answering questions that I were just cuckoo. And then I was just emotionally exhausted because, you know, the kids would argue or I would lose my temper, and I think I'm a horrible mother. And that was during a day when I didn't have the internet to turn to and read about all the things that I was not doing right, or all the things that I was missing, or how I was feeding my children the wrong foods. So I think that, you know, having young children at home for me is one of the most stressful periods in a person's life. And I think that parents with young children need to remember that, because you're not running on all cylinders ever. You're running on quarter cylinders of every aspect of your life. And so you need to give yourself tremendous amount of grace and take some walks and drink some tea and take hot baths and try not to argue with your spouse, because it's not their fault you're so tired. And wives in particular, I don't know if you do this, Christy, but whenever I'm having a really hard time, I always figure out a way to make it Walt's fault.
Yes.
And that's just not right. Yeah.
Yes. And you somehow twist it in your brain that it has to be Josh's fault somehow.
Yes. If only he would, then my life would be so much easier. And once you finally reconcile, which took me in my third decade of marriage to reconcile, that they don't really need to do that, then you can really enjoy life and kind of get along a lot better.
Can you start meeting with Christy personally one-on-one?
Sure. She can just send me her list and I can write, not his fault.
I'm liking this podcast.
Yeah, I do need it. I do.
Speaking of marriage, early on, you and your husband, Walt, because you're both pediatricians, you both had to go through med school, but you also started a family. You have an incredible story about the way you navigated this as it related to your working relationship and managing your marriage as well. Can you tell that story? Because I just think it's so amazing.
Oh, I'd love to. You know, Walt and I really had an unusual start to our marriage. We met the very first day I started medical school. And I don't even know if I told you this, Josh, but when I started medical school, I was engaged for 2 years to another man. Diamond ring on my finger and everything.
I don't know if I knew that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that Christy will enjoy this. But anyway.
I like this where this is going. This is dramatic.
Yeah. So I literally was walking down the hall with my diamond ring on my hand, starting medical school, very excited. My fiance was living in California. I was living in Cincinnati, Ohio. And I saw Walt walk down the hall, and I did the unthinkable. I slipped the ring off my finger and into my pocket. And I knew in that moment my life was never going to be the same. So
that's amazing.
Yeah. Two years. So we started dating in November, engaged in May, and married in August. And that was my first year of medical school. Wow. And so it was very, very fast. I wouldn't recommend that path for a lot of people, but this was one of these we just knew that we knew. And that was it. God just sort of threw us together. We went through medical school together, and he was a couple years ahead of me. During my fourth year, we had our first baby, which a lot of people don't do. But we really wanted to start a family, so we had our first baby. After I was done, and she was 6 months old, and we were ready to go to our residencies, he waited for me. He said to me something quite extraordinary. He said, "Now, if you know, we have to residency is about 90 hours a week. That's why they call it residency. It's insane. You're never home. You're just in the hospital all the time." Mm-hmm. And he said, "We can't both do this at the same time. It's not fair to our daughter." He said, "If I stop and stay home with her and let you go first, I know I'll go back and complete my training. But if you stop and I go first, you may not complete your training because you may feel that after 3 years you don't want to do it. You may lose heart." So he said, "You're going to go first." And I looked at this man and I thought, "Oh, my Lord, who have I married? Did I marry Jesus himself?" And I thought, wow, this is a man who grew up with a full at-home mother and three sisters and no brothers. And I thought, this is incredible. So we did. So he literally, we tromped off. We moved from Cincinnati to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I worked a gazillion hours. Every time I wanted to quit, he said, "You can't." I remember one time I was working in the ER and a child died on my watch, and it was my fault. And I came home and I said, "I'm done." And he's the one who just sort of collected me and said, "No, you've got to keep going." I did that for 3.5 years. My second year residency, I got pregnant again because we wanted more kids. We had a lot of energy. That's all I can say. I look back at it and I go, "Are you kidding?"
So yeah, this is like supernatural energy. I'm not sure where you find it.
It is. But we were such a great team. Mm. And, you know, again, this is something I didn't ask for. He just did it. And so then we had our second. And then by the time I graduated, I was pregnant with our third. So I finished 3.5 years later. And then we moved to outside Boston, where I stayed home. And then he did his residency. And then when he was done with his residency, we knew that we wanted to work together. So we thought, well, you know, outside of Boston is not an area at that time to really start a small medical practice and have control over it, because the medical climate was going more towards the big HMOs and all. So we moved to northern Michigan, where we found an opportunity to begin our own practice, which we started in 1990. And we have now, we're taking on our 8th physician in our practice, and we still practice together. And I will tell you, for any of you dads listening out there, if you ever want your wife to do anything for you, the easiest way to make that happen is to serve her. Because after Walt loved me so well for those 3.5 years, that set the stage for the rest of our marriage, which was now I feel so grateful, and I love him so much for having given me that gift, and freely, just giving it to me freely. And I think he knew then that I would give back to him. And I think we need that in our, you know, in our marriages, because really when you start to serve the other, it all comes back to you tenfold. And I think he would say that if he were here, but, you know, he's babysitting. So we've really, that was the basis of our marriage. And it's been really wonderful. Interestingly, many people say, "How do you work together in a medical practice?" And that's always a little curious to me. I said, you know, working together is easy. Now, raising kids together, that's a different story, because he was a little stricter than I, and you know, and you don't want to disagree on things that you do with your kids, but in business, you can disagree and, you know, be good buddies at the end of the day. When you disagree about how you're going to parent your kids, it's hard to be civil at the end of the day, you know?
So he was the strict one.
Yes. With our kids, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of flipped in our house.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Isn't that funny?
Christy's the strict one in our house.
But it's so prickly. Isn't it?
It is. It's so hard.
What we found is prickly about it is that it's not that I'm lenient. It's that Christy perceives me as lenient, and so she'll feel like she has to go to the other extreme. And so, you know, like one day I called her and she said, I said, "How are things going?" And she said, "We're in boot camp." And I'm like, oh boy, like, what's this about? So it's like, but we react to each other, right? I mean, we're both, she's a little strict, and she's moderately strict, and I'm moderately lenient, but we react, right? And so that was insightful for us when we started realizing
that. Meg, I just love your story, though. Oh my goodness. I mean, Josh had summarized it for me, so I kind of knew, but that's just, and I wish, so what Meg sort of mentioned there real briefly, so Walt was supposed to join us for the podcast today, but the reason he's not here is because their daughter just had twin girls, and she had to go back to work today to teach, and so he's babysitting. That's the grandpa that he is.
That's
pretty incredible.
He has a huge, huge heart. Now, of course, he isn't perfect. Like I said, he does a lot of things wrong that I have to blame him for, that he has to change. But no, not really. I always joke, you know, the first 10 years of our marriage, I studied him very hard to figure out what he needed to change. And then the next 20 years, I worked really hard on helping him change those things. And then the third decade, I just gave up and just said, okay, forget it. And we started having more fun because, you know, and it's interesting when you talk about, you know, parenting, as I think about it, because I'm not a particularly lenient parent. As I think about it, I think he was much stricter when the kids were young, and I was very strict when they were teenagers. And isn't that interesting? We sort of teeter-tottered there because I kept a pretty tight rein on them as teens because I was doing a lot of work in the teen area, and I was lecturing on teens. But certainly when they were younger, he was very much like his dad. His dad was very much like that. But because he was home with our oldest two girls when they were very young, you know, he was up with them in the night and he was feeding them and he was taking them on walks because he was the at-home parent. I think he has a different relationship, a little bit different relationship with them than the younger two, because I think that bonding that goes on in those early years is very, very important. Not that he loves them more. They love him. It's just different. I know that they lean on him for things that maybe the younger two might lean on me for. And I think a lot of it goes back to that nurturing during those early toddler years.
You know, you moved from pediatrician to becoming a writer and a best-selling author, very well-known speaker. What was the transition? What happened in your journey where you said, you know what, I'm going to step out of the, not that you completely stepped out of the medical office, but you said, I'm going to step out of the medical office a little bit more so I can start speaking and writing. What was going on in the culture? What was going on with parents? What did you see that you felt like God was calling you to do that?
Sure. Well, when we moved here, I had a fair amount of experience working with teenagers in the inner city in medical school residency, and I worked with a lot of teen and tots, you know, 15-year-old girls with the babies. And I came to Michigan thinking, okay, that's all behind me. I'm just going to sort of take care of moms who are having difficulty breastfeeding, and this is going to be so easy, and take care of strep throats and that kind of thing. Well, we came to our sort of beautiful little town, and I was, as our kids were getting moving into their pubertal and early teen years, I was upset about the hypersexualization that was going on with our kids. You know, you go to the mall and you see Abercrombie and Fitch, and at that point, you know, they had sort of obscene posters in their stores. Now, they really were just selling sex. They weren't selling clothes. And I saw this, and I was very sensitive to it because I had teen girls that were coming up, and I was trying to counter all of that. So I began seeing a lot of kids in my practice, just sort of in this nice, normal, suburban, northern Michigan town, who were sexually active at very young ages and who were coming in with infections. And I was scratching my head thinking, wait a minute, you know, there's a big disconnect between what kids are being sold and what I'm seeing behind closed doors. So I started to do some research on really the effects of early sexual activity on kids, all kids, you know. And I started just giving talks to parents about it. And parents were like, wow, no one's ever told us this. No one's told us this. Well, literally after a couple of years of that, and I was quite passionate about it, literally a publisher, an acquisition editor, was sitting in an audience listening to what I was saying and said, I've never heard anybody talk about all these problems that teenagers have. He said, we know what problems they have if they smoke and drink and take drugs, but nobody's talking about problems they could have if they're sexually active. And I said, the medical data is all over the place. And the lady literally said to me, if you come to our publishing house, which was on Capitol Hill in Washington, and give us your data and prove that you're right, we may publish a book. And I said, well, that's very nice of you, thanks, but I don't have an agent. I've never written a book. I don't know how to do it. But anyway, I just by faith got on a plane and went down there, and about 10 people around this huge oak table overlooking the Capitol, they just grilled me on my research and my data. Now, it wasn't original research I had done. I had done literature searches and literature reviews, so I wasn't conducting it. I was just reviewing it. And they said, wow, no one's ever did this. And we wrote a book, and the day my book came out, it was called Epidemic, How Teen Sex is Killing Our Kids. I was sitting across from Bill O'Reilly, my very first interview on my very first book, and he tried to chew me out chew me and chew me up and spit me out. And I got very, very angry and stayed around, and we had a discussion, and I was sort of off and running, and that was that.
And you are now, so talk about controversial stuff. You are talking about abstinence education.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden, in a culture that tends to make fun of dads, that tends to, especially in the media, Disney Channel, you see the research on that. We, you know, dads looking like buffoons, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Your focus has become on dads. And in fact, you have a brand new book that's out called Hero, Being the Strong Father Your Children Need. And I would love for you to tell us, I want to talk about Hero, but I also want to ask you questions because you also work with dads in the NFL. How did it move to dads? And what did you see there?
Well, you know, it's funny. You always know it's God doing something because you never would have done it otherwise. It just would not have been on your radar, like me going out and talking about all the problems sexually kids are having, because I thought I'd sort of left that all behind. After I wrote Strong Fathers, Strong Daughters, Josh, I really got so much mail from men, really nice guys, saying, thank you so much for saying something nice about us. Or, wow, I never believed that I could be a good dad. Mm-hmm. And these are just dads everywhere. Dads who are CEOs of company, from dads who are in jail. You know, just dads everywhere. And I realized, wow, I really hit a nerve, or this book really hit a nerve. And this goes much deeper than I thought, this idea that when you come out and you say you can be a great dad and raise a great daughter, that it sort of a light went on in men. And I saw this go on, and so I continued, you know, my work and my research. And when I delved into it and started really looking hard at television shows and articles and the internet and advertising, there's tremendous dad shaming going on. You know, dads are the butt of jokes. Dads are the people who need to be straightened out by snarky 11-year-olds. You know, dads are the ones who can't get anything right. And it's perfectly legitimate for dads to be made fun of by anybody and everybody, and nobody can say anything. Reverse that and try to do that with mothers. You'd have a civil war in your hands. You know,
yeah.
if people
so
said
true.
About mothers what they say about dads.
Yeah.
Now, so I'm seeing that going on. But again, behind closed doors in my office, I've worked with a lot of high-risk kids, eating disorders, kids with depression, anxiety, suicidal, just out of prison, just out of detention. And I have seen consistently over the years that the kids, girls or boys, who have a fairly decent dad, just a dad in the picture who will show up periodically, these are the kids who did so much better than kids who didn't have a dad. So I started digging into the dad research, and I realized that there's a huge, it's very lopsided, there's about 7-to-1 more research on mothers than there is on fathers. Now that's beginning to change.
Wow.
But what I realized is we have so grotesquely undervalued fathers. And we truly have a father crisis in our country. We have a father crisis, not just in inner cities where you literally don't have dads in the home. We have a father crisis in most American homes because fathers really don't understand who they are. They don't understand how huge they are in their kids' eyes. So what I did is I took it upon myself to write a book that attempts to show fathers who they are from behind their kids' eyes. And that's what I wrote Hero. Because every child, when they're little, looks to their dad as the smartest, biggest, kindest, bravest man in the entire world. He's bigger than life. So kids start out life with dad on that pedestal. Dads don't have to earn their way there. All dads have to do is maintain it. And so to come to a father and say, do you understand how that you're a hero in your kid's life? They go, no. You don't know me. I said, no, I'm not talking about what you think about you. I am talking about what your child thinks of you. And so that's where I'm really trying to open up dad's eyes and then give him the tools to live into that role. Not to intimidate and say, you can do this, you can do this, or you can't do that, you know, but you know, Hero means father. Father and hero are the same word. You know, we think of hero as, oh, you're an NFL player, NBA champion, or, you know, you landed a plane with only one wing or something like that, you know. But no, yeah. Hero, in the truest sense of the word, is what children ascribe to their fathers. And so that's where I'm really trying to shift, begin to slowly, in a small way, shift the pendulum and say, we need to be about the business of stopping our dad bashing for the sake of our dads and, very importantly, for the sake of the emotional, physical, and spiritual health of our kids.
You know, I, as a dad and as a counselor and researcher, I love that. When I first started, I was started in juvenile detention center at a maximum security juvenile detention center as youth development counselor, and worked in a number of different juvenile detention centers following that. And it's exactly what you said, the single biggest factor of those kids. I mean, pretty much every single kid that was in those juvenile detention centers did not even know who their father was.
Right.
Or if they
right.
did, the dad wasn't even in the picture. And of the kids whose dad was in the picture, they were out and doing well in no time. And, you know, there's so many people that believe fatherlessness is the greatest social ill of our day, because when you look at the research like you're talking about and you see the trajectory that it sets kids on, it's super powerful. But I also want to flip that, like you're saying, with dad shaming. It's hard when you have, let's just take a single dad, for instance. Let's take a dad who he's single because, mom decided she didn't want to be married to him. Maybe that was, you know, birthed out of wedlock, and mom takes the baby, and dad is ostracized or whatever that looks like, or he's not able to hold a job. And so therefore, because he has low education, that kind of thing, it's difficult for a man to feel strong, secure in who they
very
are.
Difficult. And it's very difficult. And not only does our society and our culture and media and movies and all that degrade dad, but women, good wives who love their husbands, have been trained to do so. I have found myself doing that, criticizing the way my husband was doing or something right in front of the girls, living with the belief that, well, you know, we've got three daughters, I'm the mom, he's a guy, he doesn't get how to talk to young girls, so I need to come in on conversations and straighten him out. Now, that isn't blatant dad shaming, but it's undermining him. And I believe that because mothers live with a sense that we can do it all and be it all, and we are empowered, and so we can take over everything. We don't need to be dependent on the child's father for anything, or our husband's. And it's a lie. Mm-hmm. We want people dependent on us, but we don't want to be dependent on them. And you can't have it both ways. And so once we realize that we can come face to face with the things that we're doing terribly wrong and go, okay, I can give these up, and it's going to be better for everybody if I give up this control. Life for everybody is a whole lot better.
Meg, that is so powerful, because it speaks to the, you know, those of us, I mean, just like we were talking about, how many times I find occasions to blame Josh for things.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, maybe that's human nature. I don't know that we, you know, our default is to find fault in another, but it's insidious, because it's not so blatant. It's become just, like you're saying, this undercurrent almost in society's,
yeah,
like, I don't know.
Well,
we've been
trained that way, Christy. You know,
yeah,
we've been trained to believe, and I wonder if you could get inside of every father's head and every mother's head, how many times a mother will believe that the father doing something differently will rectify her happiness, versus the father thinking, if she only would do this, then I would be happier. I bet we'd find that women do it a whole lot more frequently than men, because we are trained to believe that we need to demand and expect X, Y, and Z from our husbands, and if they don't deliver, then off with their heads. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know that men are trained to think that way about their wives. You know, I think that's what's come out of the sort of women empowering feminist movement, where You deserve it all. You can have it all. And if anything gets in your way, it's his fault.
Mm-hmm.
So move him aside. And I'm not saying that to be overly critical. I'm saying that to be honest in how this thinking in our culture has penetrated our thinking. But our meaning, those of us women who really want good marriages and who really want to do a good job parenting our children with our spouse. You know, even we are so quick to blame the bad guy in the home who's always the dad. So I think if we're honest and we say, wait a minute, I can peel that off of that thinking and stop doing that and take a little responsibility for myself and my job and let him off the hook a little bit. Boy, life is just so much nicer.
Oh,
and I say that, sorry, that's a mea culpa. I'm not pointing the fingers at anybody. I'm just sort of saying I was the queen of complaining what Walt wouldn't do. And then because I'd say you orbit the home, and I complain, he'd come in and do something, then I criticize the way he'd do it, and he'd go back into orbit and say, okay, well, whatever you, just tell me what you want me to do, because I don't really know how to please you.
Exactly. So, I don't know how to, I mean, honestly, Josh, how many times we have this conversation where it's like, I feel like I can't do anything right. I mean, those are the words he said to me. And so,
and then you got to start saying, well, this is what you do right. And this is what you do right as well.
That's a great, so that's my like follow-up question. So like practically for the moms who are, you know, we're wanting to do it right, but you just keep slipping into these old patterns. What would you say are like, I don't know, a couple practical things that we can change in our daily interactions?
Oh, easy, because this is what works for me. Make a point of, for 1 month, say two positive things that your husband is doing well in front of your kids every day.
Wow.
Make a point of saying, you know what, you are so patient, thank you so much, in front of your children, because you're changing your children's thinking. You're encouraging your husband, and you're changing your thinking, because you are stating the truth, and when you live in truth, it changes how you think. And then just buy a bunch of duct tape. Duct tape is to be used for the mouth. Whenever you feel the criticism coming out, stop. There you go again. And I feel this. I can feel it coming up in me, and I'll do stuff like, there you go again. There you go again. Oh, and by the way, you forgot our 35th and our 30th anniversary. You didn't do it. Oh, by the way, stop. That helps no one. Least of all, the person who's ruminating, which is usually the wife, who's got this slurry of criticisms in your mind ready to sort of dump out onto your husband, because you're convinced if he just changes one small thing, then life will be so much better. So stop the criticism. Make it an intentional point of once or twice a day or pointing out one or two positive things that your husband is doing, and state them out loud to him in front of the children for 1 month, and see and watch how the relationship with your children changes with their dad. Because what you're doing is not only improving your relationship with him, you're improving the children's relationship with him. And then the kids are going to be happier with you because they perceive you're happier with dad. So you benefit everybody in the circle by doing one small thing every single day. It's a life changer. It really is.
That's amazing. And for the moms and wives listening out there, go pick up a copy of Hero for him as well, so that he can know that he's a hero. I also want to, other than for dad, so let's move it away from the wives. Let's go to the dads just quickly. Other than us buying an extra few extra rounds of duct tape at Lowe's this weekend.
Did you just call them a round?
Like it was I couldn't think of the word.
Round. Oh, they come in all different colors.
Yeah,
I mean,
other than buying some extra duct tape this week at Lowe's, give some practical points for dad. Like, what does a dad need to hear today who's listening?
Yeah, I think that dads need to know one thing for sure, and that is today. Today, every single dad is wired with exactly what they need to do a good job with their kids. And it's not that they need to learn new tricks or pull things in. They need to, if you think of that wiring as sort of electricity, what they need to do is just have somebody tap it with some electricity and ignite it and get it going. So being a good dad is about letting goodness out more than changing or whatever, because I believe that so many good dads have been sort of silenced and shut up. They don't act according to their instincts. They don't protect their kids the way they want to because they're afraid they're going to look too controlling or whatever. And so, you know, dads have it all. They're wired with what they need. And the other thing is they're probably doing already a whole lot better job than they think they're doing, because being a great dad is about getting all the big stuff right, not the small stuff. And fathers so focus on all the superficial, the little stuff, what is my child, where is he going to school, what's his teacher like, what sports is he in, you know, who are his friends, do I have nice enough clothes for him? But really what matters is, are you communicating to your child every day that you want to be with him and that you like his company? Because those are the big things that kids want. Dad, do you want to be with me today? They don't care about that. Dad, do you have fun with me? Dad, do you care enough about me to say, uh-uh, you can't do that? Those are the big things that any father can do, and that's the big stuff. So that's why I really want to encourage, fathers. But I write in every chapter, I go through some real specific tools that dads can try and to practice with their kids. Very, very simple. And I know I've told you this, Josh, great parenting is very simple. It's just hard. It's like any good thing. You know, loving well seems very simple, but it's hard. But you do it over and over and over, and you eventually get it right.
And as Dory said,
just keep swimming.
Just keep swimming.
We were just talking with Meg before we went on the podcast, because our daughter was in the hospital this weekend, and our weekend didn't turn out the way we had thought. We ended up in the emergency room and in the hospital. It ended up it was pneumonia, but we just didn't know she was that sick. And so we're just tired. The weariness. And so Meg was just saying probably the best encouragement she was found in those early years was, it's you are getting ahead because you're getting by. I literally wrote that, Meg, what you said.
Good. Like, but you are getting ahead. Yeah.
Yes, because you are getting by. You are getting through, yeah. And you just keep swimming.
You do, because if you just keep swimming, life evolves and life changes, even though you're not trying to make it change and evolve. And your kids are growing and your kids are learning as you just get by. So that's where you just have to have confidence in yourself as a good mom and a good dad. You show up every day, you're there, you get them to bed and you collapse and you get up and do it the next day. And that's what being a great parent is all about.
That's so good. Meg, thank you so much for taking time with us today. We're really grateful for that.
Oh, well, thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
Make sure you check out the book Hero.
I'm seriously, genuinely excited to read that.
Yeah,
because I think as moms, we so focus on ourselves and we so focus on what the mom's struggling well and like all these things that it's like, it's all about us. And how I'm feeling convicted and like how seldom I think of the task that you are under,
Thank you.
And being more aware of how I can help you do that really well.
Thank you. I'm super excited about this book as well. And, cause I think you're right, Meg, there's nothing greater, for a child than to see their dad truly as a hero, and for dads to live out of that, that light that you're talking about. So
yeah.
Check out the show notes, check out, we will have Hero under there. Make sure you check that out and, pick it up. Thank you again, Meg.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. See you next time.
Okay. Bye-bye.
For more information and resources, or to connect with us, go to drjoshandchristy.com. We're also on Instagram and Facebook at Dr. Josh and Christy.
And be sure to head over to iTunes and subscribe to the Dr. Josh and Christy podcast. Write a review. The more positive reviews we get, the more people learn about it. Tell a friend and be sure to send us ideas, thoughts, and questions you may also want us to cover on the podcast.
It's an honor walking alongside you.
We'll see you next week.